Welcome to the Warrior Podcast with Martin Warrilow.
Hello, this is Martin, the Warrior Warrilow, with the latest edition of the Warrior Podcast. When we were researching this episode, Pete Morgan sent me a text about our guest, which just said, "Wow, what a woman." I think over the next half an hour or so, you'll quite understand why he said that about Kate Allath.
Let's go back then. Let's go back. It's going to be 10 years this year.
Anniversary on the 7th of February.
To 2010. Yeah. And it's a story you've no doubt told a number of times. What do you remember about that day?
Well, I'll tell you how I remember that day, very vividly, actually. I was on the 6th of February 2010. I was running around Chatsworth Gardens with my friends on Saturday morning doing a run, but I had a headache. And I ignored it, like lots of busy mums do, got careers, businesses, whatever. And I did the run. I had to stop someone, asked for a tablet. Had one. Next day, my headache was still there on the Sunday, the 10th. In the morning, my husband was really quite cheesed off from knowing about my headache at the time. And he told me in no uncertain terms we were going to go to hospital and get it checked out. We went to the walking centre on the Sunday at about 10 o'clock with all the kids. And I was slurring and a bit dizzy. And the very good nurse said, without alarming my daughter who was with me, "I think you ought to go to A&E just to be checked out." So we duly went. My husband had been parking the car, so he wasn't privy to that. I was feeling very bizarre and peculiar. Went to A&E. The junior doctor, because I was so fit, I was running, I mean, I had run up to 70 miles a week because I was in training to climb Kilimanjaro via the Western Route. And I was a big fell runner. Anyway, I went to the hospital. The doctor decided that, clearly, with a husband away, no family around, three young kids, a business I ran all the time, I was clearly stressed. So my BP was in normal range because, which was very high for me, but it didn't sound alarm bells because they have a range they work to in hospital, but I'm always below it. So if they knew that, they would have known that that was very out of the ordinary for me. But they sent me home with cocodamol and the instructions to go and rest. It's just a stress-induced migraine. So I duly did that. 5 hours later, woke up with the worst headache imaginable. It had not gone, it just got worse. Came downstairs, uttered the infamous words to my husband, "What's happening to me?" which came out as gobbledygook. What I thought was "what's happening to me" came out completely not that. And I collapsed on the floor and proceeded to have a huge brainstem stroke.
And then, following that, you came this period of you living with locked-in syndrome, which it sounds...
Well, what then happened was I was obviously taken to hospital. The same junior doctor was on duty, went very grey and ashen, apparently. And I was put on a life support, and the family were assembled and told to come say their goodbyes. Because if I did survive this huge brainstem stroke, I would only be, in not their words, my words, a cabbage. That's how I referred to myself. They clearly didn't. But, you know, with the pneumonia that was likely to happen and my outcomes, given my injury, in fact, my husband was told now's the time to pull the plug. Fortunately, we were getting on at the time, and he didn't.
My goodness. And how aware were you of all of this that was going on, or is this something you've found out later?
I'll tell you where I was. I wasn't vegetative. I can't say the word, but I think you get the meaning.
Yeah.
As the doctors had assumed for the first 2 weeks, I came from the medically induced coma after 3 days. They brought me round. I was able, assuming my head was in the right direction, because obviously, locked-in syndrome, in the basic terms, is you can think, feel and see everything, but move absolutely nothing. So it's like being buried alive. It's like waking up in an anaesthetic with the complete paralysis, but the anaesthetic's gone wrong and you feel all the pain and you can't tell the doctor he's cutting into your stomach or whatever. So when I woke up from the coma, I was assumed to be vegetative. I wasn't. I was fully aware of everything, but I couldn't communicate with a twitch or a flicker of the eyelid because I had no movement to indicate I could hear everything. I was obviously extremely scared, and that's putting it politely.
Yeah.
You know, I'm having breathing for me because I couldn't breathe for myself. I was on the life support. And I heard and saw things, conversations about me. Well, I wasn't obviously going to be involved in the conversations, which is important to do for anybody, to always, whether you think they can understand or not, is always to involve them. Because I heard and saw things that, quite frankly, have traumatised me over the years, the legacy, the, you know. So anyway, 2 weeks I had to endure, and continue this, but I had to endure just the company of a clock opposite me, because the TV was never put on. Awful leg cramps, horrific hallucinations with the medication I was on. The separation anxiety from a 4, 8 and 10-year-old was just horrific. And the fear of thinking, what's happening to me? Are they going to turn the machine off? Because we've all seen the films. But I'm not, I can't do anything. You know, why would I be kept, you know? And the pop-offs, which I used to call them, Christopher Reeve called them the same thing, where when after 2 weeks I had a stomach feed put in instead of being fed through the nose, and instead of having ventilation through the nose, the mouth, sorry, which was really uncomfortable, which they didn't know because I couldn't speak, obviously, but they obviously realised it must be uncomfortable, they put a tracheostomy in, and that was quite life-changing. But at the same time, I was starting to improve, and my very amazing best friend, Alison, partner in crime, she always knew and always believed that I was there, and that I can't be, you know, that is the truth, believe before I even believed it was possible. And she spotted a little flicker in my eyelids, and with that little tiny flicker, she thought she could harness that to try and get me to twitch to letters she'd point to on a board that she made herself, because the doctors didn't believe her. They assume that the relatives, on the whole, are desperate for their loved ones to be back to normal, so they think, you know, they see things they don't. But the truth is, she spotted something. They weren't doing the Glasgow coma scale as often as I was, as quickly as, and as repeating it as quickly as I was improving and recovering. So 2 weeks later, with this instructions to blink twice for yes and once for no, with her pointing at a letter, I spelt out three letters, which were S. So you go from A, blink, twitched all the way once to S, back to A, twitched all the way once to L, back to A, twitched all the way once to E. By the way, that process took 25 minutes.
Yeah.
It was horrific because she couldn't get it. She missed my flickers when she was trying to write the letter down on the board. But anyway, we eventually got there. And from that, she deduced sleep. I flittered twice. She then said, what, can't sleep? Flittered twice. And then she said, at night? Flittered twice. And all I'd done is spell out three letters. And that moment had been unlocked. Now, I was completely paralysed. It was just my eyelids. but that moment, if you like, was like every birthday, every Christmas, the birth of my children, times a million.
Yeah.
It was that moment that they know I'm in here.
Yeah. I can't imagine that almost the kind of relief and the joy that would have been in that moment of understanding between you and Alison.
Oh, because of the anxiety and the... Oh, it was horrific. It was horrific. But that in that moment, there was a bit of hope for me. It wasn't much, but there was a bit of hope.
But that's the thing. But I think sometimes I think it is that little window of hope that allows you to enlarge that window, because of course my first thought was, right, if Alison hadn't have noticed that, if she hadn't have noticed the flicker, who knows, you know, if you'd have ever been able to move anything.
I think it would have happened. I think what would have happened is I might have had another couple of weeks lying there, seeing everything, hearing everything, and no one realising, and no one trying to comfort me. I mean, I saw people dying. I heard the wailing of the families, you know, and they're all being comforted, and I'm lying in the bay next door, and, you know, nothing's happening. I had a code blue. I had a heart attack, because when they put my peg in for my stomach feed, they manhandled it, and I had a massive reaction. I mean, all sorts of scary things happened. I mean, it was horrific. I mean, fair play. The NHS have saved my life, and for that I'm forever grateful. Mm. But they also misdiagnosed me. So, you know, I kind of think we've got quits on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think we're evens, Stevens. And I think one of the things to take away from that story, which you touched on earlier on, is if there is someone in a bed, you know, if you've been told they're in a vegetative state, don't necessarily believe that. Don't talk about them as if they're not there.
I'd even go further than that. I'd say, absolutely, until you have got absolute categoric proof from a brain scan, an MRI scan, that there's no activity going on in the brain, and you've been given that, you only ever assume that they've got cognition and they can hear. Hearing, they say, is the last thing that goes. Unless you've absolutely got undeniable proof, you have to assume they can understand and hear.
Yeah. So what was the time scale then between...
Okay, well, then basically 2 weeks in, did that flicker.
Yep.
8 weeks in, I got 3 millimetre movement in my right thumb. That was it, with a bit of head movement. Week 9 in ICU, I got the opportunity to go to rehab. The nurses bought into me because my kids were their kids' ages. I was a woman who only came to hospital to have babies, and I had a rugby injury years ago at university. So I wasn't someone with Munchausen's disease, you know, that liked the attention. So they clearly took a bunch to the... I'm lucky, they took a punt on me, but I was this massive fell runner. It's like, well, if she's not going to improve, who will? So they gave me an opportunity to go to the rehab in Sheffield. And I thought, brilliant, although at the time, I have to admit, I'd glazed over, I'd got very depressed, who wouldn't, you know? I was a very active woman, and all of a sudden I'm now, in my words, a cabbage. And I can't do anything, very independent woman. It's the complete opposite of how I am.
Yeah.
So I did go to rehab. First 6 weeks, it was just petrifying, going from one to one nursing to being one of 24 on a ward where you can't communicate and use the nurse call button. So I spent hour after hour just staring at the nurse's station computer, hoping one of the nurses would look into my eyes and realise I needed something. Even when I didn't, I just thought, I might need something in an hour, so I'll keep doing it. But the stress of having to do that all day, just to catch someone's eye, was just, I can't explain it, horrific. Obviously, the indignity goes without saying, and the boredom. Oh, my God, the boredom.
Yeah.
But it was week 6 when I got the opportunity of a review, and my favourite nurse came and told me, I'm having a review, and I thought, brilliant, this is where they ramp up my therapy, the occupational therapy, the neurophysio, the speech therapy, and so on. And so I was quite excited, actually, instead of lying there pretending to be asleep when people came I didn't like. And so I was going to be in there in the big wheelchair with all my family, my best friend, the speech and language therapist, the consultant, the neurophysio, the psychologist, the OT, the nurses, everybody was going to be in this room. So I thought, brilliant. Went to the room. First thing the rehab consultant said, thank you all for coming. I have nothing more to add.
What?
Now, at that point, my trachea started to blur, and I'm thinking, that wasn't quite what I was expecting. And then, next to him, the nurse said, no change. Next to her, the OT guy said, no change. The physio said, no significant improvements, just a couple of flickers in their upper limbs. And the psychologist said, I'm depressed. I'm going to swear now. No shit, Sherlock.
I think we'll let you swear, Kate. I don't think we're going to do that.
Well, it's part of the stroke. Apparently, stroke survivors swear more. Anyway.
I know, tell me about it.
So, and at that point, I was blowing an awful lot and I was getting very distressed in my wheelchair. My family's expression said it all. And the rehab consultant then said, well, we need to be discussing discharge of Kate to a nursing care home. Now, at that point, I really lost it. I had to be wheeled back to bed. My friend got the spell board out, and the three words I spelled out, which are in my book, which has gone internationally published, by the way, stand by me. And she has, and she did, and she was an absolute star. But that moment of being written off for someone who is completely geared to proving everybody wrong, from the 13 when they said, oh, all I'd ever do was leave school at 16 and work in a factory, I was just a bit mischievous at school. I wasn't thick. But, you know, that made me go on and do A-levels and go and get a degree just to prove them all wrong, you know? So when someone said that to me, that was the catalyst for me to go, right, Kate, they've all written you off. It's down to you. And that, plus the fact that the Kilimanjaro trip I was supposed to do for my 40th, that I'd been on the radio just 4 days before my stroke happened, talking about this charity client for Bluebell Wood Children's Hospice and trying to raise some money. I never got a refund. It's like, what do you have to do? My husband decides to go on holiday with the kids on my birthday, and the nurses felt so sorry for me, they bought me a balloon. So I spent my 40th on my own in the hospital. And then in the afternoon, I went met some friends from where I lived. But not what I wanted to do, and I was very angry. So those events, the written off, the Kilimanjaro, they made me mad. Frankly, it made me want to prove everyone wrong, but it fired me up. And all then I did, used to lie in bed in the afternoons when there's no therapy. I used to work so hard in therapy. I mean, they said I worked them harder than they worked me, and that's a rehab ward. I'd lie in bed and I'd just look at every limb. Whatever range or movement I had, I'd try and increase the range, and all the time, with only 10, 15-minute breaks in between. So I'd try and get my thumb to move wider. Then it became my index finger came in, started to flicker, so that it would be trying to move it. And I could do so many before it fatigued. But then, if I kept doing it, I got more movement in the next digit. And then my wrist would move. And then I'd try and flip it over. I was obsessed. And every bit of my body, from my breathing to my lips to my mouth. And I'll give you the best example. 5 months after my stroke, I hadn't said a word. I was lying in bed, as I do in the afternoon, and I'd look at my big left toe, and my left side didn't move for 5 months. And I'd look at my toe, and I'd have an argument with myself in the head. Come on, move, damn it, staring at my toe. And I did this for 2 weeks, and this was the defining moment. After 2 weeks, I got a flicker in my left toe, big toe, and all I could think about was, if I could make that move, that being the farthest from my brain, then game on for the whole of my left side.
Yeah, because what it sounds like is, in the same way that you, to everybody else, was like, I'm going to prove you wrong, it's almost like your body was saying to you, no, I'm going to do this, I'm going to win this argument, and I'm going to move.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was obsessed. I mean, I now know the research by Dr. Robert Teasel says repetitive, frequent, intensive movement. I called it willing in my book, Running Free. It's on Amazon, by the way.
nice, good plug. Get it in anyway, there. We might as well.
I called it willing because I'm a marketeer. I am a doctor now, but I'm not a doctor in the truest sense. And it is. It was just constant willing. And I've just watched Kill Bill recently. And there's a scene in that with Uma Thurman, came out of the hospital and she's lying in the back of the car and she's staring at her toes saying, come on, wiggle. And I'm thinking, that's fictional. I did that in real life. That is exactly what I did.
Yeah, absolutely.
So do you want to know what happened then?
The
reason I say that is because it's really important because I think with anybody who's had a stroke or any illness, chronic otherwise, cancer otherwise, the goals that matter to you are the absolute key to motivating any patient. But when I moved my left side, that was when I dreamed up the most ridiculous goals that mattered to me. The first one being, I will hug my kids and I will speak to them again and tell them I love them. Then it was, I'm going to eat. I hated being nil by mouth. Absolutely hated it. I could have lynched anybody who came smelling of food. And then I was going to walk off the ward, which was going to be a ridiculous length of to walk. And then I was even going to run by my first anniversary. That, the nurses laughed at. But that was what that moment did. All of a sudden, I gave myself goals. And I used Facebook to compete against. If I put on Facebook, I'm going to sit on a plinth for 30 seconds on my own, hold my body up. If I put it on a public post, I had to do it.
Yeah.
And then all the people were following me, were going, you'll do it, you'll do it. And I post back, then I did 40 seconds. And it went up. So I used Facebook as a way to motivate me to push myself harder. It was really relentless.
Did you do those goals that you set yourself of hugging your kids, walking off the ward, running on your first anniversary?
You know, I did. I walked four times further than I've ever walked. That's on YouTube. It's very emotional. I hugged my kids. I slept with each one every night for the first 2 weeks, which was euphoric when I left hospital,
yeah.
Although it was defined by being very, very depressed because I had the PTSD. I had lost my career, my continence, my physical health, my emotional health, my ability to parent. That was where my marriage pretty much was a kibosh on that. I'd lost friends. I'd lost my purpose, sense of self-worth. I lost everything. And then also when I heard my kid say, my middle child say to his dad privately, Mum's back, but not as she was, you know, until the defining moment there, and I have to tell you this because it's really important. I was on the radio, as I told you, BBC, 4 days before my stroke,
yeah,
with a headache. When I was really literally thinking, what the hell am I going to do with myself now? What do I do? I'm just sitting at home reading books all day because I can't do anything else safely. Well, everyone goes back to their normal lives. The phone rang. It was a BBC radio producer asking me, how did my Kilimanjaro trip go? I spoke in a very, very distressed voice because I couldn't speak properly. It never happened. And I told her why in as much as I could. The next day, took me down to the radio station, went on the radio. They played the clip of my interview 4 days before. And the Roni said, but that never happened, did it, Kate? Tell us what happened. It's on YouTube as well. And I then spoke and explained. That interview, I was then the poster girl who recovered locked-in syndrome, went syndicated all around the world, went on Jeremy Vine, went on Brazil, New Zealand, everywhere. That's not interesting because I never got paid, which was a bit of a mistake. But anyway, the most interesting thing is mothers, fathers, sisters, daughters from Canada to Australia to South America to Germany would ring the station up because it's all in the newspapers and everything else. Right? Yeah. It went everywhere. Please help us. Maybe you can. There was so much demand that within 3 months of leaving hospital, after 10 months, I had to set up my charity, Fighting Strokes, which is a registered charity, and I just spent 5 years free advocating and doing research and pushing buttons from established charities to think differently, to help people be the best they can be.
Yeah.
No promises, there's just possibilities, and that's what it was. It was, you know, what matters to you, that's the crux, and then when you've figured that out, then we've got something to work with in terms of making you be the best you can be, because we're all different.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something, you know, Martin and I have discussed a number of times. Certainly when it comes to stroke survivors, is no two people have had the same experience, have got the same story to tell, and certainly no two stroke survivors have got the same set of circumstances as part of their survival. You know, with some it's speech, with some it's movement, some it's speech and movement and other things. You know, there's all kinds of things that fold into it. And I'm just interested, kind of bringing it up to date with the Stroke Survivors Day that you've got in April. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Over the years, it's been 9 years I've been doing this activism for everybody else and enjoying every moment of it, making a difference to people's lives. But every idea I've ever had has been stolen by certain charities in the UK. And it's, they've never been credited, never been asked to be involved because, you know, you can't live on advocacy work, which is free work. I mean, I'm a kind of a patient consultant with all the experience I've had, but, you know, tend to be mined for my ideas, which annoys me. Anyway, so with that, just before Christmas, I'm going through a divorce, difficult time in my personal life. I had an idea. I thought, you know, I'm fed up of hearing about stroke prevention. I've never met, in all the people I've seen, which has been hundreds over the 9 years, anybody who could have prevented their stroke, and yet all we ever hear about public health is messages is prevent your stroke, this is how to prevent strokes. And it's like, what about the amazing people who've actually survived and thrived after stroke? Why don't we have a day, like they have a day for all sorts of things now, whether it's Walk Your Dog Day or whatever, I don't know. Yeah. Why don't we have a Stroke Survivors Day? So within a minute of that, I put it out there. I got some interesting comments from people on Twitter saying, reputable, influential people saying, that's a damn good idea. And within a day, I'd chosen a day, and within a week, this is just before Christmas, I'd assembled a committee. And the idea behind it is to celebrate stroke survivors for stroke survivors by stroke survivors. Yeah. It's about not sugarcoating stroke, not saying stroke solved, fight, 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 you can do it, you can do it, you can do it. It's about being honest and saying, actually, if you're struggling at home and feeling isolated, like I know so well the isolation, then actually, we know the research said peer mentors are the best people to help you. You'll listen to a stroke survivor more, even if they haven't had the same stroke as you, then and take more notice than you would a doctor because, you know, they've been through it, they're going through it. So with that idea in mind, we've developed this committee. From that, we've mobilised a company to organise the logo free. We've actually just recorded yesterday our podcast, which will go out on the 7th. It's an international podcast because it's not just the UK-wide. Oh, no, I want to be bigger than that.
Oh, yeah.
It's on the Stroke Survivors Day, which is the international global day that I hope happens every year and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's become a movement now because we had a company do our free logo. We've had another company do our free podcast. We've had loads of people in the committee, stroke, they're all stroke survivors, chucking in their ideas and their time and their contacts, and David Swales doing the social media. I mean, it's just been great, and actually it's gaining a momentum. And the reason, and you're probably going to say, okay, well, that's great, you've got the Stroke Survivors Day. What are stroke survivors going to do? And the call to action is take a picture of yourself as you are now, doing maybe what you like doing after your stroke, with the hashtag on your photo, still me, but then post it to whatever social media you've got. We've got our own Stroke Survivors Day, Twitter and Facebook as well, with including the still me hashtag within your post so that we try and get it to go viral. Another way of getting involved is, using the still me hashtag in the post, shoot a little video of yourself saying, I'm still me because ... there's a call to action to try and get people involved. And also we're going to be, I've asked a series of questions over the last couple of weeks of stroke survivors saying, you know, what's been the biggest challenges from your stroke? A lot of people say fatigue, finances, sleeping, walking, driving, independence, sex came out, coping with divorce, because we all know divorce is a massive issue after stroke. And, you know, so I'm trying to get some positive information out there, as well as saying it's okay to have a crap day. It's okay to spend the day in bed because you can't, frankly, face the world and you've got awful fatigue. I haven't. Everybody else who probably has another stroke has duvet days. And actually, it's not about saying you're going to be fighting every day of the week. It's about saying, listen to your body, try incrementally, break down your goal into bite-sized chunks, find that goal, because what matters to you will help you find it and help you keep on track with trying to keep being better.
Yeah.
And that's it, really. It's about getting people involved. It's about positive message. It's about being honest about the crap times, and actually using each other to help us be the best we can be.
It's interesting that you've got this, and you kind of touched on something there, and I don't think I've ever asked this of any of the guests, and I don't think I've ever asked this of Martin. We talk about the limitations that occur in your life following a stroke. I'm guessing you're no longer a fell runner, and that,
no.
You know,
I have to be near a toilet.
Yeah, you know, and all those kind of things.
I've got dysphagia, so I've had 20 hospital visits with endoscopies to remove lodged food in my gullet. Yeah, I've had that. It doesn't matter what I do, because my dysphagia.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of hidden things. There's emotional stuff. There's anxiety that's caused by chronic illnesses. There's depression. There's the strain of the family issues I've got and I have had since, and the way my family's changed beyond all recognition from my family when I was 10 years ago, which hurts because you feel guilt. I couldn't have helped my stroke, but I do. I feel guilt. What parent doesn't? It's like magnitude, you know. So,
but is
the difficulties are huge.
But is there anything, being ultra optimistic, is there any kind of glass half full way to look at being a stroke survivor?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I do every day. I accept there's crap days, but my mindset is permanently on that glass half full. I can't be doing with Debbie Downers. I can't be doing with people who are negative and blaming everything on. Yeah, my strokes helped me lose so many things I held dear. But you know what? There's lots of things I can do. And if you want to focus on what you can't do now, as opposed to what you can do now, more fool you, because you've only got one life. As you know, if you've had a stroke, it's scary. It focuses your mind and sobers you very quickly.
Yeah.
So the key is focus on what you can do, not what you can't do. And you have to see, as David Swale said, stroke is not the end, it's just a new beginning. You have to find the new you. I'm never going to be the old person. However bullshit I am, and however focused I am, and however much I like to prove people wrong, and that's what motivates me, I'm different. But actually, I've met some incredible people, and I still do, and I love what I do. I mean, Christine Waddell, my favourite, I shouldn't have them, but she was my favourite, with severely long-term locked-in syndrome. She was in a headrest for 17 years, using eye gaze, no eating for 17 years.
My goodness.
2 years after hearing me on the news, I eventually set her up, well, very quickly set her up with physio. 2 years after that physio, free physio, by the way, because she was seen as a guinea pig by the company, could use the kudos if they got her to do something after 17 years of nothing. 2 years on from that Skype conversation with Christine, she posted a picture on Facebook of her eating the biggest piece of chocolate cake. and standing, able to stand off a plinth and, you know, move side to side. And she's blown my mind. She blew my mind. She was an incredible woman. But, you know, I would never have had these in my last career as a marketing, digital marketeer.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel very, very grateful that I've been able to turn my horrific experiences into such a positive in such a short space of time from leaving hospital. And that I'm very proud of, actually. But I don't do it for financial gain. That's where my speeches come in. Try and pay the bills that way. because, you know, it's just something I have to do. It's within me.
Yeah. So, what's next?
Well, what's next is the film.
Who's playing you in the film, Kate?
If Uma Thurman is free, I think you get her, because we know she can do it.
Yeah, well, she can. She's got form.
Yes.
No, the film. And seriously, it's not because I love myself. It really isn't. It's because I have a reason why I want to do it. I think it would be very entertaining with the whole idea of the, you know, the crooks being the Kilimanjaro, which was the thing that turned everything around. It was my stroke of luck, actually. And it helped me to become this person, because otherwise I'd have just got it anonymous into an abyss somewhere and probably hidden at home. I think the film, I think you have to deal with the issue of quality of life. People who have not been in a situation where they're paralysed, but yet they can still see their kids come in and they can still have their arms and limbs massaged. I know some people, like Tony Nicholson, wanted the right to die. That I 110% respect. If it's not for them, I heard of one guy who starved himself in Australia after just 2 weeks because he couldn't face being in the state. I met another guy who had a living will with his wife. If he was a boxer of an island, if he ever had a stroke or if he ever had a condition where he was paralysed and he couldn't wipe his backside, he wouldn't want to live. Sadly, that happened. He had the same as me. And he had to convince his wife through blinking that he did actually want to live, because in that situation, going out in the breeze, having the wind on your face, having your teeth brushed, seeing your kids come in and visit you and regale you about their day or their fights with their friends at school. You know, those things become big things to people who can't do anything.
Yeah.
Not everybody feels the same, and that's fine, but I know a lot of people do, and a lot of people change their mind. And my view of the film is, beyond it being a very entertaining piece and a very inspirational piece, which, let's face it, the world's pretty crap at the moment, I think it would deal with the very important message of what is quality of life. Because what is quality of life? Actually, I wasn't that cupboard. I was worth keeping. And actually, you don't know. You know, you can't make that decision. So I think society needs a discussion on quality of life, and we need to find better ways of trying to understand for people who can't speak what they really want. You know, and there's lots of brain imaging stuff that's coming out there now, new technology. So that's helpful. But I do think we shouldn't make presumptions about someone's quality of life, and I fear that's what we do.
This is the first interview we've done, Kate, where I haven't said a word for about half an hour, because...
Sorry.
I've never known him so quiet.
Because that story is so remarkable that it doesn't need me to add anything to it. But what I will say is what you said about the glass half full thing. I always say to people, my life isn't what it was, but it's a damn sight better than the alternative, which is being dead.
Exactly.
And that's what you were talking about there.
And it's absolutely. I came across a woman on YouTube. She'd lost three limbs at birth. She had one limb I was a leg, which actually just really a foot, because she didn't really have a proper leg. And do you know what? She epitomised this idea, it's not what you can't do, it's what you can do. She was an artist, paints with a foot. And it's incredible. And you know, forget this thing, you only live once. No, actually, you only die once. People need to realise, it's about experiences, it's not about material stuff. We all think we need to have the bigger car, the bigger house, this, that and the other. You know, there's not one bit of money that... You know, Richard Branson, if his chequebook came into ICU all those years ago, right, Kurt, his blank chequebook, I'll write you a check, we'll get you better. There's nothing you can do. I mean, look at Peter Schumacher. You know, he's at home in a kind of prison because, you know, fortunately he's got the wherewithal to fund his, you know, his existence. But, you know, there's no money that can fix you. And that, you know, people need to realise it's looking out and smelling the roses, basically, and go and have experiences, take your kids away, do something nice with your husband if you have one. I'm looking, by the way.
Seriously,
I won't get married again. Just put that out there now. No, it's about realising what you've got. It's not what you haven't got, not what you want to have and what you aspire to. It's about enjoying what you've got and not always looking ahead. I mean, I'm preaching now, but it's so hard. People know that, but they don't really know it until something horrific happens to them and they have to reassess their whole life. And that's the sad thing.
That's the key thing about this, isn't it, Kate, that having a stroke or having any sort of life-changing event really changes your perspective on life. It makes you realise what's important and gives you another view of the stuff that really isn't important that too many people worry about every day.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all for this episode of the Warrior Podcast. You can find out more about Martin and the work that he's doing by going to askthewarrior.com and go to iTunes to subscribe to the podcast.